must get obvious enough that I'm not ever going to change. That's the Wonder Years. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. It must be obvious at this point that this Blue Jays team is just not going to change. We've been through enough possibilities at this point. Wins that feel big and could turn things around in the moment. Big comebacks. Oh, they finally did it. They were able to put numbers on the board. A week where they actually put up offense. All the right things being said in the clubhouse from the manager. Talk of urgency. Even an extended stretch against lesser competition. And despite all of that, this team continues to just not be able to get it done more than a day at a time. This weekend, they dropped 3 of 4 to a Tigers team that came into this series struggling. Sure, yeah, a young, fun Tigers team that can pitch a little bit. You are in the position you're in as the Blue Jays. You see a Tigers team coming in on a 4-game losing streak where there are bad quotes and bad vibes around that team. You have to sense blood in the water. Instead, the Blue Jays let a Thursday series opening win roll into 2 games where once again, they can't get any offense on the board. And then, boy, Sunday. What a, yes, heartbreaker. A situation where they flipped the script on the season so far. They actually did get offense. They actually did come back in a game, and a poor Yusei Kikuchi start, which has just not happened this year. A poor game from the bullpen, which has actually happened far too often. But Jimmy Garcia was even a part of it, which he's been essentially perfect so far this season. So, they flipped the script. They did things differently, and still they come out on the wrong end of a 14-11 walk-off loss to the Tigers. Jordan Romano giving up the game-winning home run there. So you're in a spot now. You just dropped 3 of 4 to a Tigers team that's below 500 in the AL Central, a team that you absolutely had to take minimum 2 off of. You looked at this 13-game stretch. Hey, we got to go 9-4. Got to go 9-4 to get back to 500. You have not done that. You took only 2 of 3 against the White Sox in a very sweepable series. You go 1-3 against the Tigers here. And yeah, you've got 6 ahead against the White Sox and the Pirates. You can call a AAA hitter up. You can get some relievers back from the IL. You can juggle the batting order all you want. That is small stuff. Right now, this Blue Jays team, and this goes to the very highest levels, this goes to the coaching staff, this goes very much to the front office and how this roster was built. This Jays team is just not good enough right now. They're not winning games that are very winnable. They're not beating teams that they should beat. They're not competing with the teams that they're supposed to be contending against. The Jays are just bad right now. And a 3-set with the White Sox, who, by the way, are so bad that their manager is dropping F-bombs on them for being flat coming out of that weekend series. That's not going to resolve things. It is a long road back to 500 at this point. They're 6 games under. It is a long road back to respectability. It is a long road back, and certainly a road that is going to take more than the White Sox and the Pirates to get back to where anyone believes that this team can compete to the level of the expectations that we entered this season with. This is a team now that is 23-29, dead last in the AL East, 12.5 back in the division, and already 5 back of the final wild card spot at a time where the AL West has basically bowed out of the wild card race entirely. They've been outscored by 38 runs on the season. They're bottom 10 in runs scored. They're bottom 10 in runs allowed. The bullpen is the third worst in baseball and arguably even worse. There is just nothing going on for this team right now, other than, I guess, the fact that, yeah, Vlad and Bo and Varsho are all hitting at the same time. We haven't seen that yet this year. That's nice. That's how you're able to put up 11 in a game. But man, they cannot string a couple of good performances together. Again, it's the White Sox now. It's a 2 p.m. game today. By the way, it's a holiday in the United States, so make sure you're locked in early. It's Nick Nastrini again. That was supposed to be the Jays' get-right game last week. They did get offense against them, but they weren't able to kind of build on that and keep it rolling. We'll see. They could sweep the White Sox by a total score of 60-0. And I don't think any Blue Jays fan is going to feel all that much better about beating up on the worst team in the league. But that's where the bar is right now. Absolutely have to take this series, have to sweep the series. And even then, like I said, long road back, I think, before anyone starts to believe that this Blue Jays team can compete for a wild card spot, compete in the playoffs the way they were supposed to heading into this season. Things are heading off the rails, and they're heading off the rails quickly. I'm going to get back on the rails here. We have a loaded show today. Caleb Joseph is going to join us in a little bit, break down that Tigers series, preview this White Sox series. Chris Black will be on with us at 11 o'clock. Old friend Travis Snyder is going to join us around 11:30 to talk about his 3A athletics initiative and kick around some old Jays stuff. Right now, though, we go to Baseball Prospectus. We go to Forbes. We go down to New York to talk to Daniel Epstein. Daniel, thank you for taking the time out this morning, joining us on a holiday. How we doing, buddy?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. So look, man, I want to talk to you about some of your work at Baseball Prospectus, some of your work at Forbes. But before we get into that, high level, you're a baseball fan at a league-wide level. What do you make of this Blue Jays start to the season, man? I know there were some people who were, there was skepticism and things like that. Hello to your cat. I don't know that anyone thought that this team was going to be, you know, a 23-29 team here, where other teams are probably licking their chops at the Jays maybe being sellers come July. What do you make of this tough start for the Blue Jays?
Well, it's obviously not what they were expecting. I don't think it's what anyone was expecting. And you can get into the different reasons for that, and I'm sure that we will at some point. But I want to caution Blue Jays fans against, you know, lighting everything on fire just yet. We've seen in recent years a few different teams that went on to, you know, go to the World Series or win the World Series that were below 500 through May, like the Braves a few years ago. You know, it happens. Obviously, if you start 23-29, the odds are that you're going to end below 500, but it's not impossible for them to turn it around, especially for a team like the Blue Jays that everyone expected to be better. Everyone thinks they should be better. It's not like they're not buried yet. They can come back from this, even in a very competitive AL East. I wouldn't call it likely, but it's not impossible. And that's why teams don't usually make trades until right up near the deadline. You know, I mean, there are some teams that we know are going to be terrible, and yeah, they could trade whatever they have right now. Like, you know, you mentioned the White Sox. They're not, you know, coming back from where they are. They're not. But the Blue Jays, they might. Now, if 2 months from now they're still under 500, yeah, they're going to be sellers, and they should be. And then you've got to figure out how that happened and who you want to try to fix that. But that's a different conversation, and that's the reason they're not having that conversation, at least publicly, just yet, because they still can turn it around.
They can, and, you know, I'm already getting tweets off of my fired up intro there. Oh, hey, they're two sweeps away from being back to 500. Sure, they haven't won three games in a row in like a month. I'm not going to jump on that. And it's the White Sox and the Pirates potentially missing Paul Skeens and Jared Jones for that series. So I don't know that we're going to be doing backflips. But, Daniel, this is how it goes, right? It's a long season. This is why it's helpful to talk to someone who's outside of the Toronto bubble as well. It's like, yeah, there have been teams that start six games below 500 before. And get back, although their playoff odds are down to about 14% today. So it's starting to flitter away there. Daniel, reason we wanted to talk to you, the primary reason was you did this great three-part series over at Baseball Prospectus on the splitter revolution. And this is obviously relevant to Blue Jays fans because Kevin Gausman is kind of one of the leading arms of utilizing this split finger fastball that is, you know, not a very common pitch, but a very, very effective pitch. I want to get into some of that detail, but how does a two-part series have three parts is my biggest question for you.
Good question. Without getting into the fraction math of that, you know, it started out, I planned to do a two-part series. The first part was going to be on pitchers who added a splitter, who were in MLB last year and didn't throw one, who now threw one this year, because this was supposed to be the big new pitch. Just like the sweeper was a year or two ago, everyone seemed like they were throwing a brand new one. This year it was supposed to be the splitter. So the first part of the series was looking at pitchers who added one from last year. What I found with that part is that a lot of people were trying to add one in the spring training. Not many of them carried it over into the regular season. There were only about 10 of them that did. And of those 10, the only guy who was really helping a lot was Seattle's Bryce Miller, who was off to a really great start of the season. He's gotten bombed a little bit lately. So I'm glad I wrote part one before he started throwing home run balls. The second part of the series was looking at pitchers who threw one last year and still throw one this year. So, you know, for example, that would be Kevin Gausman. He would be prominent in that sample. You know, what do those splitters look like? What do those pitchers look like? Are they throwing it more? Are they throwing it less? Are they throwing it better? Kevin Gausman is not throwing it better. No. I'm very sorry. You know, his his pitches, he's primarily a fastball and splitter pitcher. He's a two-pitch guy. And, you know, they're still moving about the same. He's got the same movement. He's got similar location. That's all good. But the difference with him is that his velocity is down about a mile an hour on all of his pitches. And when you're 33 and the velocity starts to go, I'm sorry, it just usually doesn't come back. So I wish I had better news about Gausman. It just doesn't seem to look that way. And then after I wrote those two parts, I realized that there were some groups that were left out. And that's what part three was. That was pitchers who only pitched in 2023 and through splitters, like Kodai Senga of the Mets, who's been hurt all year. His ghost fork is considered a splitter. And then pitchers who only pitched in 2024 that throw a splitter, such as Yariel Rodriguez in Toronto, even though he's hurt right now. So comparing those two groups, you know, the people who we added who weren't present last year, are they throwing more splitters than the group that was present last year? So that was part three of two.
Well, it was a great three-part series. I really enjoyed it. You mentioned a couple Blue Jays in there, so let's dig in a little bit more. Yariel Rodriguez obviously has a very small sample here at the major league level, but I bring him up, one, because, yeah, he throws a splitter. Also, he had a rehab assignment yesterday, so for any Blue Jays fans who missed that, he did throw an inning and two-thirds at Triple-A Buffalo. It wasn't the best inning and two-thirds, but he got 34 pitches in. That's the most important thing for him there. Yeah, he did throw a couple of splitters in that one. We saw him throw a couple at the major league level when he was up. How, when you're looking at the quality of a pitcher's pitch, how much do you need to see it before you kind of get a feel for whether that's a good pitch or not, or not a good pitch? I know we can look at the metrics of even just a small handful, start to develop things like stuff plus. But when you're talking about evaluating, you know, hey, does Yariel Rodriguez have a splitter? Is this going to be a weapon at the major league level? How much of it would you need to see before you get confident in it?
Well, obviously, the more that you see of a pitcher and the more you see of a pitch, the more confident you're going to be in evaluating it. I think that once you're a major league pitcher, you're really good at what you do. So it's very possible to throw a pitch once or twice that you can look at and say, wow, this is a wipeout pitch. But you might not be able to see how consistently he can throw it for strikes, or how consistent the movement or the shape of that pitch is. So that's where we have to rely on metrics. You know, baseball prospectus, we have, you know, pitch evaluation metrics like Stuff Pro and Pitch Pro, which can, you know, evaluate like how effective it is. Stuff Pro is just pure stuff, looking at the movement of the pitch, looking at the velocity and how effective it is, just on stuff. Pitch Pro is the same thing, but it mixes in location as well, which is obviously a really important part of pitching. So we use that, and the larger the sample size, the more effective it's going to be. If a guy has only thrown, you know, five splitters, I'm not really looking at anything and saying, well, we know what kind of pitch this is going to be for him. That one I might rely on the eye test a little bit more, just because there's not enough of a sample for the metrics. So I may as well just look at it myself and say, okay, wow, this guy got a swing and miss on this pitch a couple of times. It looks like it's starting in the strike zone and diving pretty sharply out of it. It's moving away from left-handed hitters. It looks like a great pitch. Can't wait to see the data on it once he throws it a little bit more. But, you know, when we do have a larger sample, such as we do with Gausman, then, you know, we're going to be able to look at the metrics to tell us more than what the eye test is going to be able to tell.
And with Gausman, you know, this is something that we obviously the metrics are very valuable. And sorry for plugging Stuff Plus instead of Stuff Pro. Stuff Plus, of course, the Eno Saris, the Athletic and Fangraphs. Stuff Pro, yeah, Baseball Prospectus' cool take on it. Yeah, we're all friends. I just, you know, poor form for me to mention the wrong one. So, look, we can look at the metrics and we can see, hey, by Stuff Pro, by Pitch Pro, his splitter is not as effective this year as it was last year. I have to mention a caveat here of he did just have one of his best starts of the season in a game we don't have data for because the power was out at Comerica Park. So, you know, his 10 strikeout game, we don't know. Was the splitter getting more depth? But we've heard Kevin Gausman himself talk about how he hasn't felt the splitter was quite as good. Even that 10 strikeout game the other day, he said after the game, he's like, I didn't feel like I had my best stuff. I think it was actually good that there weren't velocity readings because the Tigers wouldn't be able to tell that I didn't have all the juice on my fastball, didn't have all the juice on my splitter. So you know, there is a velocity component here with those two pitches. I think generally the belief is that splitter guys can age a little bit better with that pitch, because if the fastball and splitter velocity both drop the same amount, you're at least getting similar separation on them still. But what have you seen kind of inside the numbers, last start aside, since we don't have kind of the data for that there, with Kevin Gausman's splitter? Uncharacteristic start to the season for him, and he's sounded like a guy who knows it.
Yeah, you know, the start in Comerica, I heard he was throwing 110 miles an hour. I don't know where that came from.
That was my read on it. I tracked it by hand, you know, with a little stopwatch, though.
So. Yeah, I mean, if I was him, that's what I would tell people. Like, oh, yeah, you know, my readings were 110. You can't prove me wrong. You know, you're right about velocity difference being a really important characteristic of splitters. It is an off-speed pitch. You know, there's basically three pitch types. There's fastballs, there's breaking balls like curveballs and sliders, and there's off-speed pitches. The most common one, of course, is a changeup, but splitters function similarly to a changeup in that velocity difference is a key characteristic just as much as some of the other things like movement, location. So if the fastball and splitter are decreasing in velocity the same amount, then that is a good thing. You don't want the two of them to totally match up with each other. But when you lose, velocity is key for every pitch. I mean, at whatever pitch you're throwing, in general, the harder you're throwing it, the better it's going to be. You know, even if it's a knuckleball, you're better off throwing a knuckleball 80 miles an hour than you are throwing it at 65. It's just the way that it works. So looking at Gausman, he's down about a mile an hour on his fastball, the splitter, everything. And we're seeing that he's not getting as many swings and misses as he used to, especially on that splitter. Guys are able to either recognize it quicker or just have a fraction of a second more to react to it because it's not getting there quite as quickly. And so they're either able to foul it off or make contact with it and, you know, either drive it into the field of play, do something with it, when in the past they just weren't quite able to catch up to it, and he was getting more whiffs with it, which is obviously a good thing for a pitcher. So when that starts to go, then, you know, that's why you see his strikeout numbers are down. He's giving up more hits per nine innings. He's giving up more base runners. And, you know, and some of that is just because of those foul balls too. Like, you know, if you were getting a swing and miss on strike three, but now the guy is able to foul it off, well, he lives to see another day, and you don't know what else he does on the next pitch or the rest of the at bat. So that's a big reason why some of his numbers are down. Batters used to just not quite be able to catch up to him. Now they're able to catch up to him a little bit more than they were before on his fastball and his splitter. And we see him start to experiment with some other things. He's throwing his sinker a lot more. I mean, a little bit more. You know, he's throwing it about 5% of the time. That's basically a new pitch for him, because he was always a strikeout guy. He was always a big swing and miss guy. Now he's not getting the same kinds of swings and misses, so he's adding the sinker, which is more of a pitch-to-contact kind of pitch. It's difficult to add a new pitch at the major league level for anybody, even a pitcher who's been as great as Gausman is for his whole career. So we'll see if that works out for him, see if he gains more confidence with that sinker as time goes on, and see if that becomes effective for him.
Yeah, we'll see. I got to write about that sinker and talk to him a little bit about it a couple weeks back. So I've been fascinated by seeing it. Eric Swanson, another splitter guy on this Blue Jays team. The Blue Jays obviously value that pitch. They have a couple guys who throw it. League-wide, hitters are hitting 183 against splitters with a 288 slugging. And that is acknowledging that Gausman and Swanson are a chunk of that sample and have not been particularly effective. 35.5% whiff rate on the splitter league-wide, and just a 6% barrel rate. So the splitter really is, you know, statistically, when we break down offense by pitch, it's one of the very hardest to hit in all of baseball. So you obviously did a lot of research for this three-part series. At a high level, why is the splitter so effective? And then the fact that it only makes up 3% of all the pitches in Major League Baseball this year, and that's an increase, is it just that hard to throw? Like, not enough guys have the hand size and seam manipulation to throw it effectively?
Well, I can't throw one, I can tell you that much.
Neither can I.
My fastball tops out maybe around 60, so don't go by me. But, you know, there's a few reasons why it isn't more common of a pitch, although it is increasing a little bit, little by little. One is that you mentioned that hitters don't hit it at all. Like the batting average against, slugging against is extremely low. And you're like, wow, people should just throw this pitch all the time. Well, that's because that's what happens when batters make contact with it. The batting average is very low. The slugging is very low. When they lay off it, it's very often a ball.
Right.
So that's not baked into those particular numbers, although it does show that it has really weak contact. And it can be a great pitch because it gets a lot of swings and misses and it gets a lot of weak contact. Those are the two best things that a pitcher can have. So that's why you're starting to see it a little bit more. But there's reasons why it kind of fell out of favor. You know, pitchers 20, 30 years ago used to throw it a lot more. I mean, I remember Roger Clemens had a great splitter. And then it died out for a little bit. There was a myth about it that it was causing injuries. And it seems like that's not really the case. You know, people thought that, like, oh, when you grip it like that, it causes an issue with the UCL and that can cause it. Doesn't really appear to be true. And we know that because the splitter never went away in the Asian leagues. Mm. A lot of these pitchers who come over from Japan, from Korea, a lot of them throw splitters. So we see that, you know, that's not really the issue. And what we know, what is really causing all these arm problems is the velocity. And that's not going away either. We see an increase in arm problems. That's because everyone's throwing harder all the time. But it's starting to come back because they realize, well, this is maybe not the cause of all these injuries like we had originally thought it was. And it can be a really effective pitch, especially against opposite side hitters. You know, right-handers can throw this against a left-handed hitter because it dives away from them. You know, it can be a platoon neutral pitch that, like I said, gets swings and misses, gets weak contact. I mentioned Bryce Miller on Seattle earlier in the show. He was a rookie last year. He had a good, not great rookie year because he's a right-handed pitcher. He could not get lefties out whatsoever. He added a splitter. He did it more successfully than anyone else who added a splitter. Mm-hmm. And then he started getting lefties out. So that turned him into a much better pitcher. And it's probably going to be a great pitch that he carries with him the rest of his career.
All right. Before I let you go here, Daniel, going outside of Toronto and the splitter a little bit here, you did write a piece at Forbes last week about Juan Soto's next potential contract. He is obviously off to a Juan Soto-ish start here. Very rare for a player this good, this young, to hit free agency. So assuming the Yankees and Soto don't work out an extension before he hits free agency, what are we looking at? Like, Shohei's obviously reset the bar here, but Shohei's his own thing. Could Juan Soto get into the territory of, you know, non-Shohei record-setting contract?
Yeah, I think so. The only relatively recent comps for someone hitting free agency this young and being this good are Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. You know, and that was already about, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. They were both free agents at 26 because they came up at 19, like Soto did. He's going to be a free agent at age 26 also. He turns 26 in October. And this is a guy with a career on-base percentage above 400. That just doesn't happen. I mean, you could argue he's the best pure hitter in Major League Baseball. He's just so ridiculously good. And being the age that he is, he's going to command a fortune. That's part of the reason you've already seen him traded twice. That just doesn't happen either. I mean, players this good don't get traded this early in their career, let alone twice. It's not because he's a bad guy or anything. By all accounts, he's a great guy, as a lovable personality, you know, seems to be a great teammate. Fans love him. So it's not anything like that. It's just that Washington traded him because they knew they couldn't lock him up to an extension, and they also knew that their team was going downhill. San Diego traded him because they knew they couldn't lock him up to an extension, and also they were trying to cut payroll this year, for better or for worse. And so he's been traded twice. Now he's with the Yankees. I know that Toronto fans are not particularly thrilled about that. He's beloved in New York. He's revitalized their offense. The Yankees had two major problems with their offense last year when they finished 82-80, their worst record since the year Derek Jeter graduated from high school. Their problems were outfield production and lack of left-handed hitters. Well, talk about, you know, the perfect fit for them. So he's come in and been exactly what they needed. And that's why you see them in first place. They've got the best record in the American League right now. And so now the question is, can the Yankees keep him? His agent is Scott Boras, who's notorious for not signing in-season extensions. The Yankees also don't typically sign in-season extensions for their players, but this is a very unique case. They don't have a Juan Soto very often. So we'll see if they end up negotiating. It seems like a great fit for the player, for the team. They might negotiate in season. They might not. They might come to a deal. They might not. I wouldn't bet on it. It's probably going to free agency. And then what happens once he gets there? We'll see. He's going to ask for $500 million, and he might get it.
He might get it. And hey, if you're coming off a World Series, maybe it's a little easier to stomach that, to hand that out. Let's hope it doesn't go down that road. Daniel Epstein of Baseball Prospectus of Forbes, thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Daniel Epstein of Baseball Prospectus of Forbes, of Subway Ghosts, the band that also includes Mike Petriello and Davey Andrews, just a Jays Talk Plus guest band, apparently. Small piece of news before we get on to a break and continue with the show. Keegan Matheson, our pal of MLB.com, reporting that Chad Green is in the Blue Jays clubhouse in Chicago. So we'll see what the corresponding move is. But Chad Green got into his third rehab appearance with AAA Buffalo on Saturday, threw 14 pitches, no worse for the wear. So it seems he is ready to go. No update quite yet on Bowden Francis, who has made three rehab appearances with Buffalo. It would seem he's ready. The results have been fine at AAA. So we'll see what they intend to do with him. Yariel Rodriguez probably needs at least one more down there through 34 pitches, 1 2/3 innings on Sunday. I'm sure we'll get a little bit more of an update on that later in the day. But Chad Green is there, so potentially a corresponding move to get a fresh arm into the bullpen. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take it back to the Jays struggles. We'll talk to Caleb Joseph, who's on Blue Jays Central all weekend, breaking that one down, and will be with us for Blue Jays Central for the entirety of this White Sox series. Caleb Joseph next as Jays Talk Plus continues, the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
By the way, 7:40 for Tuesday and Wednesday. It'll be Chris Bassitt, Nick Pastrini today, Kevin Gausman, Mike Clevenger tomorrow, and Alec Manoa against Chris Flexen for the series finale. Ranted off the top a little bit about how, you know, squandering that series the way they did against the Detroit Tigers leaves them in a spot where, I mean, first of all, even if you beat up on the White Sox here, I'm not sure anyone's going to feel all that much better about it. That's kind of a necessity at this point, and got a couple of replies of like, yeah, well, if they sweep the White Sox and they sweep the Pirates, they're still back to 500. That would mean they still went 9-4 on this 13-game stretch. Yeah, sure. If they do that, then those things will be true. And I will say that and say, well, not even say my bad, because it'll still mean you picked on, you know, you got those wins against very, very bad teams in the case of the White Sox, and pretty bad teams in the case of the Pirates, especially if, as it looks right now, we're going to miss Skeens and Jared Jones, and that is because Jared Jones is scheduled to pitch Tuesday, Paul Skeens is scheduled to pitch Wednesday, and they have off days on either side of those, so you're not going to see them, which sucks as a fan perspective. Not the worst thing if you're the Blue Jays and you're just trying to get some wins together. Last time the Jays saw Nick Nastrini, they hammered him. It was kind of their get-right game, or it was supposed to be. The bats came alive a little bit. The bats have been going pretty well since then. Not really. They have had some big games, but it's been very feast or famine. Obviously, the bats were going yesterday in scoring 11 in the 14-11 loss against the Tigers, but came up pretty empty on Friday and Saturday against Nick Nastrini. Nastrini ended up going 3 1/3 inning. The White Sox just kind of left them out there and were like, we got to get you to take as much of this as you can. He walked 6 batters. The Jays also got to him for 7 hits. That was all over 3 1/3 inning. 9 runs, 8 of those earned, including a home run. That was the return of the home run jacket, if you remember. Bo Bichette putting that on. Dalton Varsho also had a triple. It was a multi-hit game for Bo, who now has 5 of those in his last 7 games. So, look, on the offensive side, they're a bit of a weird team to make heads or tails of right now, because they went from never scoring to now they've had this kind of boom or bust little stretch here. They had, of course, that big game against the Twins, you know, where they scored 10. And then they went a whole week without really scoring much again. And then they put up 9 on the White Sox twice, and then 9 on the Tigers, and then 11 against the Tigers. So they have had those 4 games, by the way, were all in the last week. They've scored 9 or more runs 4 times in the last week. And it still feels like, you know, the team hasn't really gotten out of gear. And that's because, well, they went 3-4 over that stretch, and they mixed in getting shut out at the hands of Garrett Crochet, who they won't see in this series, and putting up 2-1 runs respectively on Friday and Saturday against the Tigers. So within that, look, there are some positive trends offensively. You don't score 9 runs or more 4 times in a week if some things aren't going well. And I know it's not going to make anyone feel all that much better about where they are, but I'm spinning my wheels a little bit as we wait for Caleb Joseph. So look, Vlad had 4 hits yesterday. If we look at his last 24 games now, he's hitting .409 over that stretch. 24 games. That's basically a month of baseball. He's hitting .409. He has an OPS over 1,000 now. It's 1.019. He has 8 extra base hits over that span. So that's still a little on the light side, but the doubles have started to come around a little bit. That's a positive there. By the way, if we're not going to get, we might not get Caleb Joseph here. So if you have texts for us, 590, 590, you can text in your thoughts from the weekend. You know, would a sweep against the White Sox here mean anything to you? Or is it kind of the bare minimum that the Jays have to do here? Where are you at after a very frustrating weekend? We went into the weekend trying to be positive. You know, the Jays had won, they had won 4 of 5. It was the first time they had done that in a little bit. They put up big numbers against the White Sox and Tigers a couple times in a row. It was a pretty dispiriting weekend. I don't think anyone was celebrating and, you know, doing the earnest they're back on Friday, but it was certainly a more positive vibe before they squandered that Tigers series. So let us know how you're feeling. You could text 590, 590. I mentioned Vlad. Now we're looking at a 24-game stretch where he's hit over 400, has an OPS over 1,000. 8 extra base hits. And again, he did hit that 423-foot home run to dead center field in a very large Comerica Park on Thursday. You'd like to see a little bit more home run power. Sure, he's got a bunch of doubles of late. I think you have to be encouraged by what you're seeing from him. Dalton Barshow also has 3 home runs in his last 6 games. I wanted to ask Caleb, you know, is he seeing anything specific there? Is this just a streaky hitter getting on a heater? We know Dalton Barshow has been pretty streaky with the power stroke in the past. Even if it is just, hey, he's run into a couple and he's hot right now, the Jays will take it. There was a stretch earlier in the season where he was the only guy hitting for power and he was kind of floating the offense there. He's doing this at a time now where at least Vlad and Bo are hitting with him. Danny Jansen's continued to hit pretty well when in that lineup, when in the two-hole. Bo, by the way, I mentioned earlier, has 5 multi-hit games in his last 7. Over his last 15 games, he has an OPS up around .955, and he has as many extra base hits as he has strikeouts. So I know there's still some frustration sometimes, you know, Bo expanding the zone, taking a bad swing here and there. As many extra base hits as strikeouts over the last 15 games. That's 6, by the way. That's encouraging there. The 5 multi-hit games is encouraging. So those are the good things. On the other side, there are not a lot of the other thing here is if all that's going well offensively, they're still having games where they put up 1, they put up 2. There are obviously some things that are not going particularly well. Justin Turner came in as a pinch hitter yesterday. He went 0 for 2. He is now mired in a 3 for 44 stretch on the season. George Springer is having the season he's having. We could call it one big extended stretch if you really wanted, but he's hitting .188 with a .264 OBP, a .273 slugging. And yeah, he's got it done a little bit in the field and on the bases. He has 7 stolen bases. The strikeout rate's down, all that stuff. But we're at a point where a lineup that has Justin Turner and George Springer in there as everyday fixtures, let alone hitting 2nd and 5th, is going to be tough even if the other guys are hitting. One other offensive note here before we take a couple texts to 590, 590. The Jays are, and I got asked this one a bunch over the weekend. This is why I pulled the number. The Jays are 27th in the league in runs per first inning. So bottom 5 scoring in the first inning. They're 28th in first inning OPS. And they have not scored a run in the first inning in 18 games. 18 games since you last scored a run in the first inning. That's quite a stretch of play here. Someone who didn't sign their text, leave your name and your number, or sorry, not your number, your name and your location, by the way, so we can shout you out. Someone asked about moving Isaiah Kiner-Falefa up in the lineup. He's been hot lately. I mean, maybe a spot or two. There is a long track record of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa not being a plus hitter. Valuable guy to have as a utility piece who can bounce around, does a little bit with his legs. Obviously, a nice glove at multiple positions there. But even right now, like hitting 270 with a 719 OPS, they'll take it. The offensive side of that's kind of found money. This is this is by far a career year right now, or a career month and a half for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. So I think you'd run into pretty quickly what you ran into with Whit Merrifield last year, which is, you know, it goes the other way pretty quickly. If you want to hit him seventh instead of eighth and ninth, cool. I don't know that the profile is there to be a high order hitter for very long, especially now that you do have, you know, Vlad and Bo and Varsho going a little bit and Danny Jansen in that two spot most of the time. Jeff from St. Thomas, shout out to St. Thomas, says bad teams find a way to lose. Retool is needed. Look, they are finding ways to lose lately. Look, there are good teams in baseball who will blow a ninth inning game after coming back. I don't know that anyone will do it in as on the nose fashion as the Blue Jays right now, coming all the way back after bad Kikuchi start, rough bullpen day. You come back, you have that big Varsho home run. Kevin Biggio calls it a really nice moment for the team, and then it unravels there. So we'll continue with some texts here. Doug from Burlington says, run differential tells me the Blue Jays would be better to retool and make some deals. You don't ideally want Ross Atkins to do this. Who would be the ideal candidate for the GM job? So Doug, this is it's an interesting question, and it's part of why, in general, I'm not a huge believer in in-season changes, because, you know, if a guy wasn't going to be the guy to steward things throughout the season, why did he have the job coming into the season? You can't do a full GM search in season when you've still got day-to-day business to conduct. Some of the candidates are in roles for other teams. I think what the Blue Jays would probably do is the remaining pieces, whether that's James Click, who's been in an advisor role, whether that's Mark Shapiro taking on more of the baseball ops role. I think it would probably be something that's cobbled together internally in the interim before a full search took place in the offseason. That's the unfortunate nature of making those changes on the fly in season. But I think it's a very meaningful question and a relevant question, especially if the Jays are going to hit a spot where they have to focus on selling some pieces so that 2025 can be a brighter season, so that there's a little bit more in the farm system for the years moving forward beyond that. This front office has already handled one kind of tear down and rebuild. Do you get a second one? I don't know that you can do that, Doug. As someone, again, who didn't sign theirs, again, leave your name and location so we can shout you out. Hey, Blake, I honestly don't know how Romano has been an all-star. It seems like luck has carried him this far. It seems like every batter hits a hard line drive, and it's sure luck to find glove. I mean, look, man, we got 4 years saying that Jordan Romano is a pretty good relief pitcher. Yes, he blew that one yesterday. He has not been super effective in tied games, in non-safe situations when he comes in. But other than Josh Hader, he has blown fewer saves than anyone in safe situations. I don't think that's all luck. He does give up some hard contact. It hasn't been his best year. You know, the slider and the fastball, neither has been quite as sharp as usual. And yesterday sucked. There's no way around it. That was a really unfortunate ending. But to say that 4 years of success has come down just to batted ball luck and finding gloves, I don't think that's fair. We can have a more reasonable conversation about the Jordan Romano role and what Jordan Romano is doing right now. But relievers are so volatile, I would find it really hard to believe that someone lucked into being a really good reliever for 4 years in a row. James on Vancouver Island asks, bring up Aurelvis Martinez, Springer and Turner not showing up. Look, Aurelvis is, it's worth saying, someone from AAA could come up. I mentioned off the top, like, you should still be in favor of those things. The micro decisions, the small margins, those things still matter. And they will, you know, they could potentially help, whether it's Martinez, Barger, Nathan Lucas, Spencer Horwitz, who I did a piece on Blue Jay Central on Saturday. But, you know, it's the high-level guys not getting it done for the Blue Jays right now. That was Vlad and Bo and Springer for a long stretch. Springer has 2 years left on his deal. It's not like they're going to send him out to pasture. What you're looking at is, yeah, maybe Turner gets a few fewer plate appearances. Maybe Springer gets a few fewer plate appearances. And now suddenly a guy like Spencer Horwitz or Relvis Martinez, who you were like, maybe he's only going to get one a game. Well, suddenly there's three games a week there instead of one game a week. I will say Relvis Martinez at the plate has cooled off pretty notably for Buffalo of late, still hitting for power there, but the numbers have come down. He's hitting about 240. He has not been as hot as when we were talking about him earlier in the season. I think Spencer Horwitz would probably be the guy who got the call next, but we'll see how that plays out. Let's see how Chris Black is feeling. He's a producer at Sportsnet. He's at Down to Black on Twitter, king of the Twitter threads. He's joining us a few minutes early here in place of Caleb Joseph. Chris, welcome, man. How we doing? How was your weekend producing a couple losses on Blue Jay Central?
The results weren't great, but to be honest, working with Danielle, working with Caleb, always have a blast. Lots of golf stories from Caleb always. He's not golfing right now. The weather is too bad outside to be golfing. We will find Caleb Joseph. It was crazy ups and downs yesterday in this studio. Early start, we were all a little tired. And then to have that Varsho moment followed up so quickly by your best reliever, arguably your best pitcher all season, giving it up, that was tough.
Yeah, it's a tough one, certainly. And to lose three in a row to Detroit. Chris, we had talked about, hey, they could go 9-4 over this 13-game stretch and they'd be back to 500, et cetera. And maybe you could make do with that. They could technically still do that. They could sweep the White Sox and the Pirates. Color me skeptical that that's going to happen. But did dropping 3-4 against the Tigers, before we get into some of the specifics, did that kind of change where you're at in terms of the outlook of how and when this team can get back to, I don't mean to say that, like, if they swept these next six and got back to 500, that wouldn't be relevant. It would be. You'd be back at 500 on June 3rd. But the fact that the Tigers are the best of those couple teams that they're going to see here, and that they, again, weren't all that competitive at the plate Friday, Saturday. Just how are you feeling about this 13-game window and where the Jays are big picture?
Yeah, they haven't met expectations. I mean, they haven't met expectations all season, but it's always weird because I always find it's a weird dynamic. It reminds me of the end of that Washington series, where if they win that last game in the Washington series, it's just one game, but the vibes are completely different. Mm-hmm. Same with yesterday, which is so weird. Like, if they hold on and get that win, it's really not that different in terms of overall where they are in the season. But the vibes and the conversations that we're talking about right now, like, we're talking about the best comeback win of the year. We're talking about getting some momentum going against Chicago. Like, so it's weird that I don't think either, if we would have been having those conversations, I don't think those would have been completely accurate. And I also don't think the sky is falling. Like, it's bad. It's very bad. And what's the part that stood out glaringly to me yesterday, and it hit me over the head on the weekend, was this team's pitching, the decline in their pitching and the decline in their performance, the ERA year over year, like, that is way more shocking to me than what's happened offensively to them so far this season.
Yeah, so let's take a look here. There's a board on the screen there for those of you viewing on TV that shows the largest ERA increase year over year for any team. The Blue Jays are at the top of that list. The Astros and the Rays also increasing their ERA by a half a run. But for the Jays, the very top there, 0.61 runs of ERA. They're 15th in starter ERA, 28th in bullpen ERA, 21st overall in terms of runs allowed per game. So there are a couple different theories here. The personnel, as far as Major League Baseball in 2024 goes, remarkable stability personnel-wise year to year for this Blue Jays team. So it's not a big personnel change. The fifth starter spot has juggled a little bit. The two back-end bullpen spots have juggled a little bit, as with every team. But the core four starters are the same. The core four or five bullpen guys are the same. Where did your eyes go first? By the way, sorry, one other note. I pulled a bunch of numbers on the Jays bullpen, and there is, like, not an area that they're doing even league average in. They are dead last in homers per nine, dead last in home run per fly ball, dead last in hard hit rate. For the amount that you care about teams' ability to pull the ball in the air, they're dead last in pull rate against opponents as well, second to last in ground ball rate, second to last in swing and miss rate, bottom 10 in chase rate. So how often guys are swinging outside the zone, bottom 10 in strikeout versus walk. There is just, they're even dead last in expected ERA. So if we want to look at some of the Statcast metrics and hey, did they get unfortunate? No, they're 30th in expected ERA as well. This is bullpen specific, by the way, I want to get into here. So let's focus on the bullpen first. Man, where do you go first when you hear all of that? The Jays last or close to last in basically every bullpen metric we have.
Yeah, I mean, the first place I looked, to be honest, and this is just team-wide stuff, the first place I looked was like, is any of this unlucky? Like, it is, because sometimes small sample, early part of the year, is it unlucky? And what you quickly come to realize is this pitching performance, this year-over-year increase, is earned. Hard hit rate, barrel rate, exit velo, whatever you want to call it, like, it's, they've earned it. It's not unlucky. It's not, they're not getting BABIPed to death. They're not getting, you know, there's not, fly balls aren't leaving at an abnormally high rate. Like, it is high, but they were high last year and still found success. So it's not like too many balls are flying over the fence, unluckily. So the first place I landed was there. Like, they've earned this performance. So that was the first place. The next thing that kind of that I looked at was Stuff Plus, Location Plus, those metrics you were talking about in your first segment, which I was listening to, all that's the same team-wide. Like, there are some individual year-over-year changes, but on a team-wide basis, they're top 10 in Stuff Plus, just like they were last year, and they're middle of the pack in Location Plus, just like they were last year. And the crazy thing is, like, some people will think those metrics are too abstract and what does that really mean? But it's the quality of the pitches that you're throwing, right? And if you look at the top 10 in Stuff Plus last year, they averaged about 88 wins. They were on average like 10th in ERA. So the stuff translates to results and it translates to wins. Those same numbers are holding up this year, but the Blue Jays are just an exception to the rule. They've got good stuff. Their location's okay, but something else is going on, and I don't have a firm answer yet, but it's not a stuff thing. It's not unlucky, but their pitching results have gotten, again, like as we alluded to earlier, their year over year is higher than anything else. And like, the when you compare it to their offense is down a little over half a run per game. It is, but eight teams have been higher, have a bigger drop this year, including the Dodgers, the Braves, the Rays. So yeah, their offense has been worse this year, year over year, but that's been kind of the trend league wide. But it's the, so in that environment for their pitching to be this much worse, that's the shocking part of the season so far to me.
It is. It really is shocking. And again, there's not a lot of personnel change here. And you could maybe think, well, oh, maybe they're too old. Well, I pulled those numbers too, and I this was a crude metric, so it's not perfect, but I put together really quickly this morning a weighted based on who's pitched the most. Are the Jays the oldest, you know, are they too old? They're not. They've had a bunch of 27-year-olds pitch, like Hennessy Cabrera is 27, Nate Pierce is 27, Bowden Francis is 28. You know, Chad Green, who's one of the older guys, hasn't really pitched that much. So it's not really an age thing. They're on the higher end. I think they're the fifth oldest pitching staff in baseball when we waited for, you know, innings, but that's largely due to the fact that they have a pretty veteran starting rotation. It's not the bullpen there, so it's not personnel changes, it's not that these guys have gotten too old, it's not that the stuff isn't there. The stuff isn't like unbelievable. They're what, 12th in stuff as a bullpen and ninth overall as a staff, so it's not that. And I guess, look, we know Chad Green's in Chicago today. We haven't heard the corresponding roster move. Bowden Francis and Yariel Rodriguez have both been on rehab assignments as well. But I don't know. Like, is like the Nate Pearson spot hasn't been that great. Okay, you can change that. Zach Pop has had, you know, an okay stint. Maybe he goes down. Maybe Hennessy Cabrera goes down. But those, like, getting a couple guys back healthy who are not your top end guys is probably not resolving this either. Also, like, every team in baseball has two or three pitcher relievers on the IL.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to diagnose, right? And in our line of work, and we always want to find answers to this stuff. And baseball usually provides answers. It's the sport that can give us answers numerically or looking. If you do a deep dive on something, you can find an answer. Two things, I know we're coming up to a break, but two things that stuck out in terms of when I did a little bit of a deeper dive. Two strike counts, the Blue Jays are like far and away maybe the worst performing pitching staff. Hmm. So run value per 100, home runs allowed. They're really struggling in two strike counts. Again, why? I don't know yet. And the other thing that kind of stands out is two strike fastballs. So is that something where a dynamic can change? But like they're giving up close to a 400 slug on two strike fastballs when they throw them. The rest of the league is like 270, 280. So it's just, you know, there's something. And if you look at Stuff Plus, this is where it brings us back to where I first looked. The quality of their fastballs has dropped year over year. Now, we've seen that with Kevin Gausman, as you were talking about in your first half hour. There's a couple other guys. So as a staff, the quality of their off-speed stuff, the quality of their breaking stuff is pretty much the same. The quality of their fastballs has dropped. And you're seeing that's where they're getting hit hard. Like they're getting the damage they're giving up, and where they're struggling is against fastballs. So maybe that's an adjustment, but that's also a hard adjustment to make. You can't just go away from fastballs, but maybe you can go away more. Maybe they need to lean into more breaking balls, more off speed, especially in two strike counts.
Yeah. And you know, maybe that's the case with Romano, who kind of hovers around that 50-50 slider fastball split. Jimmy Garcia has had the best fastball in baseball by expected results so far.
Yeah. His fastball is lights out. His fastball is lightning. He's not the problem here, but guys like Gausman, guys like Chris Bassett, even guys like that. And again, that's where maybe it is age related. I don't know, but the quality of their fastballs has dropped, and they're giving up damage on fastballs this year.
Chris, don't worry about the break. We're juggling a break here, just given the way the okay. guest stuff. By the way, for anyone listening, Caleb Joseph is going to join us on the other side of the break just after 11. So we're just juggling things a little bit here. When it comes to the age component of this, I don't want to be doomsday-ish about this, but we all know the reality that if things continue as they have for the Blue Jays, they're probably going to have to sell a little bit at the trade deadline. And, you know, our eyes immediately go to the guys who are pending free agents, because they could walk for nothing if not. But the fact that when we dig in here a little bit, there are a couple guys who are a little older on the rotation side, and the results have come down a little bit, even if the underlying stuff is still pretty solid. As you dig in further, does it change your willingness to maybe it's not just the guys who are about to be free agents who are potentially available?
I still think it's too early for those conversations. Okay. We're in May. I don't think you're wrong in what you were saying, responding to a few of the tweets or messages that are being sent to you. It won't change things if they sweep the White Sox and if they, pull back to 500. There's still questions that remain, but it's still too early to talk about blowing things up. And listen, when you get gut punched like that as a fan yesterday, like, you're going to have visceral reactions. I was listening to Jay's talk on the way home. I was texting with some people I work with. Like, it's, you have strong reactions to games like that. It's what kills us as sports fans, but it's also what brings us back. Like, that's why we watch these things. Like, I enjoy, like, that Marshall home run, that comeback, like, that was, like, a high moment of the season. It's just it got passed by a really low moment almost immediately after. So I'm not at the point yet where I'm talking about who do you move and stuff like that. We might be there in 2 weeks. We might be there earlier than it usually comes. It might be a June thing, but, May, I still feel like it's early, but maybe that's just me.
No, it's not just you. That is the reasonable take on this. And if we're being completely realistic, like, we are minimum 5 weeks away from the Blue Jays engaging with those things actually. Maybe this is a week or two premature for me to bring it up. I do have 10 hours a week to fill. And the people demand blood after you lose three in a row to a team that came into that series. Like, the Tigers had lost five in a row before they just took three against the Blue Jays. Now, that's how quickly things can change, obviously. But it is funny. Like, you could... you could talk about this series for the Tigers the same way we were talking about it hypothetically for the Blue Jays. The Tigers, you know, on paper and on expectation level, not where the Blue Jays are, but their fan base is probably having a very different conversation on talk radio today where, oh, they're back a little bit. They just beat a team that's, you know, was coming in urgent and took three off of them. So yeah, the conversation changes a little quicker here than it probably does in the Blue Jays front office as they kind of evaluate these things. Okay, so the Jays do have three against the White Sox here. They have three against the Pirates, where, as I've mentioned, unfortunately for us as baseball fans, no Jared Jones, no Paul Skeens, but fortunately for the Blue Jays, they won't miss those two electric, or they won't face those two electric pitchers. So let's look at this White Sox series. They just took two or three against them. The White Sox are down bad enough that their manager was calling them out with F-bombs in post-game media availability yesterday. What are you looking for from the Blue Jays? Like, baseball is not a sport like some other sports where you can, like, feel that level of, like, oh, we're going to come out and punch him in the mouth and, you know, we need to take three and we need to set the tone. It doesn't work like that. The Jays have gone 18 games in a row without scoring a run in the first inning. Maybe that's something your eyes are turned. But what are you looking for from this series, particularly today against Nick Nastrini, a guy they just had their get right game against last week?
I just want to see offensive improvement continue. I know there were some down games, but, you know, seeing what we're seeing from Vladdy, seeing what we're seeing from Varsho continuing, we talked last week about him. Like, I wasn't too concerned about the mild downturn in offensive production. And so to see him have that big moment yesterday was really encouraging. Vladdy, by a 35 game stretch, again, this is what I've been saying for a week or two now, like, this stretch is longer than people think for Vladdy. Like, it's about, if you look at 35 games now, he's at like a 350 average and a 430 on base. And those are his best stretches since 21. So if we keep seeing this Vladdy, if we keep seeing some other marginal improvements, this team is flawed. We know that. But, like, that's what I'm looking for. For it to continue and to get back to 500 is that offensive improvement continuing to come. We saw some good Bo Bichette at-bats. Saw him have a really nice at-bat to tie it up, or at least I can't remember if it was to tie it up or to bring them closer yesterday. But I thought that was a big moment for him, especially I thought he had a little bit of a just like a momentary lapse in concentration on the bases when Vogelbach hit that liner and he got doubled off yesterday. So to see him rebound from that and have a moment like, you know, if the offense can come, like, again, like, this pitching, it doesn't make sense. Like, it really doesn't make sense what's happening. This was the other number I came across. We always talk about OPS plus, ERA plus on our broadcast. Fangraphs says ERA minus, which is just, I almost prefer it in terms of how to measure both park adjusted and kind of year adjusted. They were 90 last year, which is really, really good, 10% better than league average. For context, 1985 was the best in franchise history. 2008 was second best, which is a super underrated team. For those of you, if you're new to covering, to watching the Blue Jays, following them, Halliday, Markham, BJ Ryan in the pen, Jesse Carlson, just a really, really good pitching staff.
Also the last team who had the, that's the year of Blue Jays, the drought of no more than five runs in a game for 20 straight.
Yeah.
That was that team. So a lot of parallels, that era to this era.
Yeah. There's a story from that year. I'm not going to tell the whole story, but I ran into the pitching coach of that team at a bar in Cleveland. And we bought him and a couple of guys who was with a beer. And we were like, man, if your team could hit, you guys would be in the playoffs. And he was like, you're damn right we would be. So shout out Brett Arnsberg. But anyways, to bring me back to the point I was making, their ERA minus, and again, this is about league-wide offense being down, and yet their ERA has jumped. Their ERA minus is 114 right now. That's the second highest in franchise history. So comparatively to the league, to the park they're playing in, they're pitching really, really poorly. And it's shocking to me. Like, none of us saw this coming. They're spending a lot of money on the rotation. They're spending a lot of money on the bullpen. None of us saw this coming, and we don't really know what's happening.
We don't. It's a tough one. The offensive side was a little bit more predictable, not to the degree that we saw, obviously, but we, you know, the idea was they could be an average offense and pitch their way to a lot of victories. It's turned out they've been a bad offense and they can't pitch their way. So something's got to give here. That one of the sides, ideally both of the sides, will get back where they need to go. Chris Black, thanks for taking the time this morning, man. Appreciate the timing flexibility here as well. You kind of bailed me out.
My job as a producer is to always bail out our analysts like Caleb Joseph. I did it today. I did it all weekend. I'll continue to do it in the future. So you make sure you tell him that I said that.
All right. Great hair day as well. Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, at Down to Black on Twitter for all your Twitter threads. Sorry for the lineup juggling here a little bit, guys. We're going to take a break on the other side. We'll talk to Caleb Joseph. We'll talk to Travis Snyder as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Caleb, good morning, man. What's going on?
Lion Jays, thank you so much, Chris Black, for picking me up there. I owe him. I owe him a lot.
Nah, you don't give him the credit. You can do that on Blue Jay Central off air or whatever, but yeah, you don't need to do that. Caleb, how are you doing, man? That was a tough weekend of games. Obviously, a great weekend. You and Danielle Michaud on Blue Jay Central. I got to come and spend some time with you guys on Saturday. But, you know, you've had a night to sleep on it. Three tough losses for the Blue Jays there and maybe the toughest of the season yesterday. How are you feeling?
Demoralized. I think that might be the best word for me right now. And I remember as a player being in these types of situations, these types of games, they know what's going on. They know the sense of urgency. They know the part of the schedule. They know what the task is at hand. And you could tell the energy was trying to flip on that Dalton Barshow home run. That's about as animated as I have ever seen Dalton Barshow and that clubhouse this season, for that matter. And then just to get punched right back in the mouth in the ninth inning is just demoralizing. As a player, you feel like there are defining moments in seasons like this, where at the end of the year, when you've made the playoffs, won a couple of games, you look back and you say, that fourth game in Detroit when Dalton hit the home run, that was the turning point in our season. A lot of times you have those moments you see on reviews of teams. And I thought maybe that could be it. Maybe that could be the moment. And then to give it up in the ninth is just, it's just crushing. And there's only so many body blows you can take before you just feel disheartened. They're professionals. They'll show up today. They'll strap it on and try and get after it. But these do something to you mentally. I've been there, and you keep fighting, but you got to have some momentum at some point.
And there's been a few of these now, and you're right. Momentum is a key word. This is a Blue Jays team that hasn't really strung wins together. You know, last week they won 4 out of 5, and that felt like, you know, maybe the winds have changed, even with a lesser schedule there, and immediately it kind of fell through their fingers there. So, Caleb, you're a vet in that locker room. How do you come in today? And yeah, it's the White Sox, so maybe that ends up helping you, but how does this team come in and try to make sure that yesterday, you know, you said it could have been part of the DVD highlight package if DVDs still existed. How do you make sure it's not a part of the negative, the unraveling of the 2024 Toronto Blue Jays kind of DVD highlight reel?
Yeah, Buck Martinez has alluded to this multiple times on the broadcast this year, that each player has got to look in the mirror and they've got to say, what do I have to do today to help the team win? And you just have to get it done. You've got to get it done. There's going to be days where you're not hitting, where you don't have your best slider, you don't have your best command, you don't have command of the zone, you're not seeing the pitches well from the other side. There's just a way that you've got to impact the game, and they've got to sync it up. We're going to talk a little bit more in depth tonight on Blue Jay Central before the game. But they've got to find a way to sync it up. You just got to get it done, and there's just no excuses. They've found spurts where each part of their game has clicked, but as a whole, they haven't been able to do it for 3, 4, 5, 6 straight games to get more momentum. So as a veteran in there, You try and stay positive as best you can. But this is honestly the time where a lot of people say, hey, you got to come together. You got to have a team meeting. But reality is, this is the time where you got to individually get very, very selfish and start saying, what is my job? What am I supposed to bring to the club each and every day? What's my role? And I have got to get it done. And if 25 guys can do that, and 25 guys can do it for 4, 5, 6 games in a row, you can start to build momentum. So as much as you want to be positive inside the clubhouse, each guy on that team has just got to start getting it done all together in the same game. Do it again tomorrow. Do it again the next day. Do it again next series, and then reassess where you're at.
That's an interesting perspective. You know, we do always hear about it from the team perspective, and we've heard this team has already had those closed door team meetings and things like that. But yeah, the kind of the collective has to be 26 individually right now is an interesting twist on that, Caleb. Look, this is a team that you know really well, not just because you cover them, but because you were on that 2020 team. That was kind of maybe not year one even, because the expectations weren't there yet. We'll call it year zero of this core and this window. When you see now that we're in, you know, year four of that, you were, if we don't count that 2020 season where it was kind of, you know, the pandemic and expanded playoff field and everything like that, this is year four. The fact that they still haven't been able to do that as a group, and some of the pieces has changed, but the core pieces, you know, are there. And I don't necessarily mean just like Bo and Vlad, but, you know, a couple of the rotation pieces have been there for a couple of years. A couple of the bullpen arms have been there for a couple of years. You know, your Danny Jansen's, Kevin Biggio's, George Springer's, those guys have all been there for a couple of years now. Does it worry you at all that, like, we're in kind of year four now of, with the exception of that late run in 2021, kind of waiting for things to click and waiting for this team to show they can be a momentum team?
I think Bo Bichette said this earlier on in this year. It's one thing to win when you're not expected to win, and it's another thing to win when you are expected to win. And it just shows how difficult it is to be expected to win and do it consistently year in, year out. Just look at the Yankees. The Yankees spend a lot of money. They're the perennial franchise in sports history, right? And it's still very difficult to win. They've got superstars all over that lineup. It is just tough. And having the experience of some veteran guys here and there and veteran coaching staffs, it really helps out being able to go through the ups and downs of being expected to win. 2020, we overperformed. And the challenge is, how do you get through the tough times when you are underperforming the expectation? And I went through that as a player on a different organization, expected to win. We weren't doing it. And then the pressure mounts even more. You look at an organization like Tampa, and this is why I think they can lay in the weeds as long as they can, because even though everybody on the outside knows that the Tampa Rays are very good, they still aren't truly expected to, like, do big things. People know they're going to do big things, but I don't think the city of Tampa is putting World Series on billboards saying, we're going to win the World Series. They just kind of show up and do their job, and Kevin Cash finds a way to plug all the right pieces in the right spots, and they just kind of end up winning, because I don't feel like the super pressure to win is on them from the outside that it is in other markets. And I feel like the Blue Jays are in that position where you talk about Bo, Vladdy, some of these core players, they've been brought in here to actually win. And pro sports is tough. It's why you look at some of these dynasties that the Yankees had, even some of the NFL teams and NBA teams that they've been able to sustain winning for a long time. It is truly remarkable. People think that if you have talent and you can spend a lot of money and you've got some good process behind it, it just equals winning. And the pressure, performance pressure of winning is really, really real. I can promise you that. And when it starts heading downhill, it's very hard to stop that snowball, start pushing it uphill, make it dissolve, and then create your own destiny. Very, very difficult. I still believe they can turn it around, but their window is shrinking considerably.
Yeah, and look, the White Sox are a good team to turn it around against. Not that, you know, again, sweeping them is not going to make anyone celebrate, but if there were ever a time to face the last place team, this could be a good one. Caleb, that's a lot of really good kind of high-level insight as to where these guys might be at mentally right now. Did want to hit on a couple of the specifics from the loss. from yesterday. Dig in a little bit. Yusei Kikuchi struggled in that one. Only three swing and miss his entire outing. Didn't strike anyone out. What didn't you like about what Yusei Kikuchi had yesterday?
Good question. I didn't love that the curveball was hit the way it was. I thought that's been a really good pitch. Maybe it was something with the Tigers' game plan against him. Looked like they were a little bit more aggressive than they normally are. Tigers typically a very patient team in the zone, not swinging at a ton of pitches. Very, very patient, but it looked like they kind of ambushed him a little bit. The fastball velocity was fluctuating, and some of that, I'm not sure if that's Yusei, if it's the start time. We covered this. It 11:30 games. I played in two or three of those 11:30 games in the minor leagues, and I wasn't even awake until about the fourth or fifth inning. Major League Baseball players, such creatures of habit, and they're professionals. They're going to get up. They're going to go get ready. But your body clock is just on a certain level. This is a nice point, but somebody listening probably is going to say, yeah, well, the Detroit Tigers were on the same exact body clock that you're talking about, and they came out swinging. And so it's not an excuse, but sometimes I don't look as much at like velocity when you have a very, very odd start time. I was hoping that he would be able to turn it around and be able to give them some length so that the bullpen wasn't exposed, because the bullpen's a bit of a mess for me. It's really concerning to me. But he just got ambushed. He had too many balls in the zone, wasn't really hitting the spots. When he did hit the spot, they got weak contact for hits. And when he missed his spot, it was hard contact for extra base hits. So rough outing for him. He's been very, very good for the Blue Jays. If there was ever a game for the Blue Jays to score 11 runs and bail him out, it was yesterday, but the bullpen couldn't hold together.
Yeah, you mentioned the bullpen has been as bad as they are, and that was, you know, that's a tough decision for John Schneider, I think, is Kikuchi doesn't have it and his pitch count isn't up. But do you ask him for another inning when he clearly doesn't have it? Do you go to that bullpen that hasn't been very good but hasn't been super heavily worked? So you had a number of fresh guys, and then right. It unravels as it did. I think we can all give Jimmy Garcia a pass. It then comes down to Jordan Romano. He hangs a slider a little bit to Matt Vierling on that last pitch of the game. Jordan Romano hasn't had the best of seasons yet so far. A little bit of a late start to his season, sitting there with a 6.39 ERA now. What have you made of Romano's season so far, Caleb?
Up and down. And it just shows the importance of spring training. And I think in this day and age, spring training is just a little bit too relaxed. Guys kind of go through the motions a bit at times because there's not consistent, really super consistent work for the entirety of it. Guys are allowed to kind of ramp up, and it's all about numbers and pitch counts and really, really protecting players. And when you miss time, especially in a more relaxed spring training than the spring trainings that have occurred in the past, it really does throw you for a loop. Look at Kevin Gausman, for example. He was very delayed in the spring training process. It's been an uphill battle for him the entire time. And again, talking about creatures of habit, these guys have come in for most of their careers when they're healthy and have a full spring training and then rushed into duty. Jordan Romano was after what was it, just one minor league start, maybe two, and felt ready. And it's an uphill battle. I do think, too, that when he comes in non-save situations, he, for some reason, he's just a different guy. I don't think it's intensity. I don't think it's focus. I don't think it's intent. He looked focused. He looked excited to pitch. It had been a minute since he pitched. The stuff, it looked fine to me, and it's just a matter of hanging a couple pitches here and there, working behind the count. For some reason, when he comes in a non-save situation, it just doesn't work out the way it does when he is in a save situation. But all these factors are concerning, because this is kind of the guy you want to shut it down. Again, if Richards doesn't give up the homer, Pop doesn't give up the homer. I mean, the only guy that came out of the bullpen that didn't give up a run was Eric Swanson, who just got his ERA under 10. So imagine that. But it's the long ball that's absolutely killing this pitching staff. And 9 times out of 10, late in the game, when you give it up, it's coming via the long ball.
Yeah, and this is a bullpen that is dead last in home runs per 9 and home runs per fly ball. And it's not particularly close. It's everyone else and then a big gap and then this Blue Jays bullpen. Caleb, not sure if you've got a chance to take a look at the lineup card yet for today, but George Springer's hitting seventh. Justin Turner, once again, not starting. Turner in a 3-for-44 stretch here. He did get a look in the two hole the other day, but back to a bench and pinch hitting role after that. Is this something that we should probably expect to see a little bit more until he figures it out? Turner maybe not being an everyday guy, kind of being a platoon guy with an asterisk because he'll get the odd start against righties?
Yeah, the Jays are in desperation mode. They need wins, and they need wins now. And you're trying as a manager to balance what you have to do right now and trying to find spots to get Turner hot. If the team is going to get to where they need to get to, they need both Springer and Turner to be on their game. But you can't bury the season this early by continuing to throw them in the lineup if they're zeros right now. So it's a very weird gray area that they're trying to hang in. And I love the fact that he came off the bench, Turner, that is, and got the pinch hit single, earned him that two-hole spot, but then a little bit more of the same. What concerns me about Turner is that he got off to a really great start, and I just hope it's not product of environment. Really nice start doing his own thing, and I guarantee you he's doing a lot of heavy lifting trying to help out quite a few of the struggling Jays hitters early on in the season, and I wonder how much that has affected him. And just as much as hitting is contagious, slumping can be contagious as well. So I do feel like they're going to play the hot hand until they can get some of that momentum and then start to sprinkle guys in. But the eye test, it tells you everything right now. You could look back at track record. Justin Turner might hit 400 off of a guy, but the eye test in its current form, I'm not trusting the track record because the sample size is so deep. You want to trust a 12-year veteran, a guy that has been a pro for a long time, figured it out, knows how to make adjustments. But when the team is in absolute desperation mode to win games, you've got to play the guys that have been hitting the ball hard recently, and that's what John Schneider's doing again today.
Caleb, before I let you go here, everyone pretty much hit the ball hard against Nick Nastrini last time they saw him. The Jays were able to put up 9 runs on Nick Nastrini. They're seeing him again. Nastrini hasn't pitched since then. They're getting another look at him here. Is that, seeing a guy twice in close succession here, obviously he didn't have very good results. Does that favor the hitting side here? Like, should we expect the Jays, hey, we saw him good last time. He didn't have the zone. We hit him hard. That should carry over into this one, seeing a guy again a week later?
Yeah, it just depends on who can make the adjustment the fastest. You know that he's going to come out and try and do a few things differently, try and get the ball on the corners a little bit better and on the plate for that matter. And then can the Jays adjust? He might try and move it around in different areas than he did have. And so it's one of those questions where do you go in with the exact same game plan, hope that he makes the same mistakes, or do you kind of slow it down a little bit, see where he wants to go and not try and rush the outcome and then try and attack him? Obviously, as a hitter, you want to do everything the same, thinking, all right, same process and I'll get the same results. But you got to be on high alert because pitchers, especially when you're facing a team as consecutively as you are today, they have the same info that the Jays have. They have the same video. He's watching the exact same game. And I promise you, he's not an idiot. He's not going to do the exact same thing, or else he will find himself in AAA. So it's just about adjustments. This game is all about adjustments. The fastest to make the adjustment, who can do it most consistently, typically sticks. So hopefully, if he does make mistakes, they can take advantage like they did. And if he does start to make adjustments, they can find that and use that to their strength.
Caleb Joseph, appreciate you making the adjustment and coming on with us when you did here around 11:10. Another adjustment for you. You're with Brad Fay today instead of Danielle Michaud or Jamie Campbell on Blue Jay Central. Adjustments all over the place for you.
Well, you are the one making the adjustment, so you guys deserve the credit. Thank you so much.
Caleb Joseph of Sportsnet on Blue Jay Central today. That'll come to you at 1:30 because it's a 2:10 game today. It is Caleb Joseph with Brad Fay, Jamie Campbell off for the weekend. It'll be Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the TV side, Ben and Chris on the radio side, and we've got Shai Davidi down in Chicago writing for .ca. And yes, thank you to Chris Black for juggling. Thank you to producer Amit Mann for juggling as well, and Jennifer Rolnick, Lance Kennedy being flexible with those breaks around the 11 o'clock hour. This isn't the end of the show, even though I'm thanking those people. I just want to thank them because they're doing a great job, and I appreciate it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to the CEO and co-founder of 3A Athletics, also a guy you know very, very well as a Toronto Blue Jays fan. It's Travis Snyder. It's the Lunchbox Hero. Next, this Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm going to change directions a little bit here for this segment. Talk to a guest we spoke to each of the last couple of years as well, someone Toronto Blue Jays fans know very well. He is a former Blue Jay. He is the co-founder, CEO, and CFO of 3A Athletics. It's Travis Snyder. Travis, good morning, man. Nice to talk to you again. How we doing?
I'm doing great. Sitting out here looking at the sun shining and looking forward to the opportunity to chat.
Yeah, it's got to be, I mean, you're not in the same climate we are, but it's got to be peak grill season coming up for you, right?
Yeah, we've kind of had back and forth. We had some 75, back down to some 55. I think we're going to have about 64 and sunny today. So we're getting there. I cooked up and pulled pork up yesterday and had a fire going. So we're almost summertime.
Beautiful. And I hear birds chirping in the background, man. What could be better here? Appreciate you taking the time again. Look, Travis, we've talked about a couple times now when you've come on this show in the past about what you're trying to do in your post-playing career. And since we last talked to you, I think the last time we talked to you, the Hero books had just come out, those interactive guidebooks for parents of young athletes, specialized for each sport, which you can find on Amazon. Since then, you know, 3A Athletics has picked up steam a little bit. You're kind of doing the press rounds. For those who haven't heard you explain this before, can you give us a little bit of the background on 3A Athletics and what you're trying to do here in your post-playing career, making things better for the next generation of athletes and how we train them?
Yeah, I think it comes down to mental health. It's something I spoke on throughout my career and since I've been done, the struggles that I've had on and off the field. And re-entering the space of youth sports with three kids on the coaching side, as well as being involved in an organization for a short period of time, I realized how much the landscape has changed, how much pressure is being put on these kids at such a young age, and how many parents feel that pressure to try and keep up with what has been normalized. So for me, it's an opportunity to really dive into the grassroots level of all sports. Obviously, baseball is my platform, but we came out with the Parent Guidebook, which is an interactive guidebook for parents to really go through a therapeutic process and understand how difficult that relationship can be with your child and the sport that they play. Helping them communicate with coaches through difficult situations, because we all know that it's difficult when you see your child not on the field playing as much or not playing the position you think, and helping parents have intentional conversations with their kids about how they feel throughout this process. So it becomes more about the kids' wants and needs than it does the parents. And I think that's a difficult thing to balance as parents, right? Because we're always trying to do what's best for our kids. But at some point, we got to encourage them to speak up, have their voice, and decide what it is they actually want to pursue when it comes to sports and life. So focusing on the parent-child relationship, we also have Athlete's Journal that's designed for kids 13 to 18. And this just takes them through their own kind of therapeutic journaling process of identity, what is the conscious and subconscious mind, mindset, what are triggers and how do they affect the way that we perform on the field, your parent relationship and your coach relationship. And again, it's learning how to speak your truth, really discovering what it is consciously and subconsciously that makes you motivated and what are the things that make you avoid doing the things you know you need to do to get better. So we really try and put a good spin on the journaling experience for kids. And then we'll have a Coach's Revolution, which is a coach's therapeutic guidebook coming out. And then we have 12 episodes of a workshop podcast that's based more on the educational side of this process, but really helping parents understand where they're at and their kids are at in the developmental process. Because a kid 0 to 10 has much different needs than a kid who's 14, 16, 18 years old thinking about playing baseball or sports at the next level. So we want to help parents better understand where the kids are at in that process and what they can expect.
So a lot of resources there. Again, it's 3A Athletics Awareness Activation Achievement. And for the parents, it's HERO, the interactive guidebooks. And then on the player side, it's From Good to Great, that series of athlete journals. And then the coaching component coming out soon as well that we'll keep an eye on. And you mentioned something within there, Travis. Obviously, we want to do all of this stuff because we want kids to be healthier and feel better about themselves and their role in sport, et cetera. You also said how we perform on the field. So there is a performance component to this as well. And I know, again, I don't want to discount the element of we want to build healthier children and make sure the relationship with sport, the relationship with coaches, the relationship with parents are in strong and fulfilling places. But there's also a performance component where, you know, in your eyes and in your experience as a professional player, this is a way to build better rounded athletes as well. And the kids themselves will be able to perform better if they're in a better place mentally.
Yeah, I think creating self-awareness is a huge step in becoming better at something, right? It could be as a player, what do I need to get better at? And there are opportunities for players, athletes to write that down in this journal. But really understanding the foundation of all this, right, is identity. And if we have solid foundation of identity and who we are versus what we do, and not being just the baseball player, but being the kid with a ton of energy who loves to get after it and work hard, that's who you are, not the baseball player, right? And really trying to help separate that for kids so that as they have more success, as they have, you know, experiences with failure, they're going to be standing on a much sturdier foundation to be able to work through and deal with those things, because dealing with failure is an important life lesson, but also dealing with success. And that's something I struggled with a lot of my career, being a first-round pick and being so young in the major leagues, is I allowed my ego to kind of take the wheel and create all these expectations and listen to all the outside noise instead of staying true to my moral compass and doing what I knew I needed to do every single day to stay grounded and stay humbled. So, again, 99% of these kids will never play in the major leagues, and that's fine. And that's not what I'm trying to, you know, come out here and say we're going to make more major league baseball players. But I want to see kids have a healthier experience, be able to reach their true potential, right? Not bringing the ceiling down because we have so many outside opinions and state rankings and national rankings. Like, no, let's get away from all that stuff. Let's really focus on the individual and what each person needs, right? Because it's different. Your children are different than my children. Even within the three of my kids, they're different. So, again, it's allowing kids to build this sense of identity and choose their path and forge forward with a different understanding of who they are versus what they do.
And it's really important work, Travis, and appreciate you, as always, kind of sharing your personal story with us and the entire baseball media. I know The Athletic had a great profile on you and the work you're trying to do the other week as well. I've also seen, you know, there's a good amount of support out there for what you're trying to do from others in the baseball community. I know if you go on the 3A Athletics website, there are, you know, Jose Bautista's talking, Russell Martin's talking. It really does seem like the feedback among current players has been there as well. What does that mean to you? What does that tell you about what you're trying to do here when other guys are speaking up and saying, you know what, that's really relevant to my experience too. I'm glad Travis is doing this.
Yeah, I mean, me and old buddy JP and CB went down to the MLB alumni conference down in Vegas, and we spoke on a mental transition panel, right? And I ended up crying my eyes out for about 20 minutes on the stage, telling my story and explaining to people through marriage counseling, through my own therapeutic work, you know, how tough it's been for me to separate my value away from being a baseball player. And I'd gone as an attendee the year before, and I looked around and I saw, I don't know, 75, 100 guys that were in the same exact position, right? That had just retired, did not know what value they brought to the world outside of throwing a fastball or hitting home runs. And I think, again, the world of sports is just such a beautiful thing that we get to watch and be a part of as fans and just go to the games and experience that energy. But again, they're human beings on the field. And I think that looking at this kind of lower level of youth sports is really where these things start to kind of build up for better or for worse. And I think that's, again, when I talk to guys that are in the space with their own kids or guys that are still playing, they're kind of going through it on their own. It just, again, it's something I think that hits home for everybody in some form or fashion. And again, it's something that I wake up every morning excited to get to work and focus on these kinds of things, because I know the type of impact we want to have and how we really want to change the culture of youth sports.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, man. I'm glad it's been a fulfilling project for you and a fulfilling journey for you. You mentioned a couple guys who, you know, they have kids and they're going through it with their own kids now. Whether this is, you know, former player friends like Ricky Romero, who I know does some coaching with his kids, or just the parents you're working with in general, what has that feedback been like on the parent side. I imagine it's pretty eye-opening for parents to hear that their kids might be dealing with this kind of stuff in, you know, their teens or even earlier than their teens, these performance anxieties, this difficulty balancing the pressures of sport. Have parents been pretty receptive once their eyes are open to what you're trying to kind of show them here?
Yeah, and I think part of our process, part of our mission is learning how to destigmatize words like trauma and triggers, right? Because depending on what culture and what part of the world you're in, you're using these types of words, it can be difficult for people to comprehend what do I mean by trauma, right? And there's a massive scale of very intense trauma to just a negative experience, right? So we're really trying to work through the idea of rewrapping some of these messages so that they are more digestible to the average person who's maybe not in that therapeutic type of space. But for the most part, we've gotten really, really positive feedback from parents and from kids, and having these conversations with 16, 17, 18-year-old kids that are going through this process in high school and trying to play golf or trying to play baseball at the next level, and really helping them understand like what their value is in this world is not your stat line. It is not your ranking in the state. And as cool as those things are, those are a product of the process, right? Which we'll dive into more with some of our stuff. But again, it's helping kids understand that these are healthy human skills that you're developing that are going to transfer outside of whatever sports you play into the real world and make you a more successful, a more content human being, understanding what your value is.
All right, Travis, I want to pivot off of the three athletics work just a little bit here. You are a former Blue Jay, and we like to do some, you know, former Blue Jays memories stuff when you do come on. I don't think I got to talk to you last year around the Jose Bautista Level of Excellence Day. That was kind of a, you know, Blue Jays of my vintage, of your vintage reunion there. How special was that weekend for you to get to be a part of here in Toronto?
God, it was awesome. I got to hang out with Adam Lind and Keisha Lind, who I lived with at one point in AAA. Obviously, seeing Jose, I mean, he had a million people pulling him in every direction, but got to see him. Russell Martin, who ended up going on a golf trip with me to Bandon Dunes and witnessing my first hole-in-one.
Nice.
And, you know, a handful of other guys. I think Ricky was there. again, just being – Cito was there. I got to hang out with Cito. Dwayne Murphy, got to chop it up and kind of laugh about the struggles that I went through and just the dynamics of our relationship and how, you know, being a 22, 23-year-old kid who can get kind of stubborn and get triggered pretty quickly. It was just fun to have those conversations with those guys and not have the pressure of having to go perform that night, you know what I mean? Or walking around the big city and having somebody tell you, hey, great game, or hey, you suck last night. So again, being able to go back to Toronto and just experience the city as a whole, the culture, and get to see my old teammates, man. We get to hang out in a suite and watch baseball and just chop it up. I had a blast.
Man, tell me a little bit more about this hole in one.
Oh yeah. So it was it's the par three. It's the Preserve. It was 140 yard par three, and took an 8-iron, knocked it down. There was a hill behind, and literally as I hit the ball, my buddy was articulating kind of what the shot to make a hole in one would be, and I literally hit the spot that he pointed out, and it rolled back in. And because it was a par three course, we could play eight guys in the group. So it was me, Russ, and six of my buddies from back home that I golf with on a regular basis. So I mean, just the closest thing to a walk-off that I've ever experienced outside of the world of baseball. You know, clubs are flying, everybody's throwing jabs and just screaming, and the groups that can see us around the course are screaming because they know something cool happens. So, I mean, just, again, I tough to compare things to playing in the major leagues, but that was definitely up there for me.
That sounds awesome. I doubt very much that I'll hit one day, but I'll let you know if my experience is similar. Travis, last one before I let you go here. The other week, it would have been Roy Halladay's birthday. I saw you tweet out, he's the hardest worker you've ever seen. What do you remember about that legendary work ethic from, you know, a guy who I think is a lot of our, in Toronto here, a lot of people's, if not favorite player, very much in the mix for favorite player, favorite Blue Jay, in your case, probably one of your favorite teammates?
Yeah, I think, can't put it all into words, but I think back to JP and I trying to beat Roy as the young rookies to the field in spring training, because we were really trying to show the vets that we were bought in and we were working hard. So we'd try and roll in there at about 6 or 5:45, and Doc would come walking out of the weight room, just kind of give us a grunt, and he'd be dripping sweat. And it was like, you could never find a way to get an edge on Roy when it came to showing up and outworking him. And I think those people in the media remember, somebody had shared this when I tweeted out, just like how if they didn't catch Roy at the right time, they knew they were going to have to wait 45 minutes for him to finish his routine, right? And he was just so committed to his process, to being great. And I know, you know, he grinded through a lot of stuff in his career physically, mentally, and emotionally. But just as somebody who took the ball every fifth day and went out there and grinded, obviously his stats and all that stuff are Hall of Fame, right? But the person, the work ethic was just second to none. I can't say there's one guy I've shared a clubhouse with that outworked Roy Halladay.
Yeah, that's a cool story to hear, man, and a great piece of Roy's legacy. Travis, a great piece of your legacy will be the work you're doing at 3A Athletics, trying to make youth sports a healthier, more holistic place for our youth athletes. I really appreciate you taking the time out. Really appreciate all the work you're doing, man.
Yeah, thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to come on here and talk about it. And shout out to all the Jays fans. Hopefully the boys can get this thing righted and we can start to see some more W's up there.
Yeah, it sure would be nice, Travis. Thanks again, buddy.
All right, guys.
Travis Snyder, former Toronto Blue Jay, co-founder of 3A Athletics. You can go check that out, read up more, especially if you're a parent or a coach of youth athlete, or if you're a youth athlete yourself. There are interactive guidebooks for parents of young athletes called Hero. Those are available on that website as well as Amazon. And then from the athlete side, from good to great, athlete journals. So again, great work Travis Snyder is doing at 3A Athletics. Make sure you check that out. And he's right. Hopefully the Blue Jays can get a couple more wins going in their direction here. They'll try to do that at 2:10 today against Nick Nastrini and the Chicago White Sox. The Chicago White Sox, who are in such disarray, 15-39, that their manager is dropping F-bombs, calling out the players' effort, calling them, certain word, flat on the weekend. So things not very good for the White Sox since we last left them. Chris Bassett, Nick Nastrini today, Kevin Gausman, Mike Clevenger tomorrow, Alek Manoah, Chris Flexen in the finale on Wednesday before the Blue Jays finally get a day off. The Jays need to, they need a win today. They need a series win. They probably need a sweep here for this kind of 13-game stretch against lesser competition to feel any kind of positive. They just saw Nick Nastrini. They really got to him. Pretty much everyone got something going against them. Dalton Varsho tripled, Bo Bichette homered. They went 7-for-17 with 6 walks as a team. Pretty good stat line. We'll see how it looks getting to see him a second time. If you don't remember, you missed that game, Nastrini's going to throw his fastball about half the time, comes in around 93, 94 for the most part. Righties will see a heavy dose of his slider, does get some swing and miss, but he, at least in his 3 major league starts this year, he hangs that thing a bunch. You can get to it. Players are slugging 529 off the slider. Lefties will see a changeup and a curveball instead. Similar story there with the changeup. He'll get some swing and miss with it, but guys have really been able to hit it. And that's not just in a 3-game sample at this level, although he has faced some tough competition when he's been up. He was also struggling at AAA before he got the call here. ERA up near 6. And even if you acknowledge that in Charlotte there, their AAA team, that is not a particularly pitcher-friendly park, you still probably don't want an ERA up around 7 in AAA. We'll see if Nastrini can right his ship a little bit, can get back on the right track. On the other side, Chris Bassett did do pretty well mowing down that White Sox team. There were a couple lefties who still got hits, but that was probably Chris Bassett's best start of the season. He's seen these guys a lot over the years. Martin Maldonado, if he's going to play today, is 1-for-16 against them career. Andrew Benintendi has some decent career numbers, but really has not had a good season and has basically not been an every single day player. He's kind of in the same situation that the Jays are in with Justin Turner, where, you know, is that an everyday thing? Maybe it's only in Benintendi's case, the strong side of a platoon. In Turner's case, he's not in the lineup today. Maybe it's the short side of the platoon plus an extra start here or there against right-handed hitting. So Turner's not in the lineup today. The lineup looks as follows: Davis Schneider, Danny Jansen, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, Daniel Vogelbach will hit in the 5 spot and DH. Like I said, Justin Turner's out today. Dalton Varsho hits 6th, go lefty-lefty there in the 5-6 hole. And then George Springer is hitting 7th, as our pal Chris Black points out. This is the lowest he has ever hit. 11-year career, over 1,200 games. This is the first time he's hit as low as 7th in the order. He is hitting 188 with a 537 OPS. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa and Kevin Biggio round out the order, hitting 8th and 9th respectively. The Jeff Merrick Show is coming up now. Blair and Barker will be with you for Jays Talk post-game, and then things get back to normal tomorrow. I'll be in the 10 to 12 spot as usual. Thanks to Dan Epstein, Caleb Joseph, Chris Black, and Travis Snyder for coming on with us today. Thanks to producer Amit Mann for helping me juggle there. Thanks to Lance Kennedy and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. 2:10 p.m., Chris Bassett, Nick Nastrini. The Jays badly need a win. You badly need a win, the listener. I could use a win here as well. We'll see if the Jays can get it. We'll talk to you again at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a wonderful Monday, everyone.